After all of that, our guest speaker tonight needs no introduction, but I don't mean to say he's not going to get one. Those of you who are regulars at St Lawrence will know Paul, of course, who has been a member of St Lawrence now for many years and was a fairly recent church warden, a very successful one, following and filling the very, very difficult boots of Ray Hayden, which couldn't have been the best thing in the world to try and do, but he actually made a spectacular job of it. Paul has studied, researched and written extensively on the Great War, as we know it, the First World War, for those who are too young to call it anything else, and has recently actually taken a party around the battlefields. They're in. Hands up those who went. At least two of this company did. Yep. The other one, yeah, there we go. And we understand that was very successful and an extremely good and interesting time had by all. Paul is currently in the process of writing articles for The Bridge. You'll see them come up.
Yeah.
Every time there's a bridge, there's something interesting to read.
Yeah. Mm.
In fact, not a lot of the time when the bridge comes up, it's probably the only thing. So without more ado, Paul.
I guess that comprehensive introduction really concludes my presentation. A couple of weeks ago in church, somebody said to me that this evening brought together two things of particular interest to me. I assume they meant eating and talking. So I'm going to bring in a third one, which, as Gordon has alluded to, is the Great War. And my specific focus this evening will be on the role of chaplains in the First World War. And the... touch very briefly in 20 minutes on the impact that they had. Clearly in 1914, I think a lot more people were active in services on Sundays than perhaps today. And there seem to be remarkably few personal accounts of the Great War that refer to aspects of Christianity during the conflict. But one of them was from a chap called George Venables, who was a Coldstreamer. And he wrote as follows. He said, "We're bound to live from hour to hour, not knowing what will come next. What a great thing it is to know one is a Christian, and therefore can say his will is best." And shortly we'll look at some examples, or four examples, of well-known chaplains from the Great War. But I was quite reassured to come across a reference by the well-known historian Peter Liddell, who wrote about some of the well-known chaplains. And he acknowledged that these men and others kept aflame unknown numbers of guttering candles of faith of the British soldier at war. Now, the British Army had chaplains for a long time. The Army Chaplains Department was formed in 1796. And this is I assume in India, from the Indian General Service Medal, taken post-1864 from the style of his frock coat. And certainly throughout that time, they would have had quite a mixed reception. And one of those is recorded by a Royal Engineer, a chap called Sapper Percy Room, who was attending a church parade in Bayeux in northern France. And he wrote as follows. He said, "The chaplain was an archdeacon. He had fine delivery, but his material was nothing exceptional. His message was not practical enough. Tommies want something that is interesting, straight to the point, with good wholesome truths." Anyway, in spring 1918, he wrote again, and he said, gets worse by the way, "I felt disgusted with the church parade we were forced to attend this morning. We paraded at 11:15 a.m. and were inspected by the CO. And after about half an hour standing in the sun, we were eventually formed up round a table where the chaplain was officiating. Fellows were cursing about the parade, and I'm inclined, and I'm convinced, parades of this kind do more harm than good. Yet the army may force some things upon the men, but I'm afraid that their attempts with religion are a dismal failure." Anyway, he wrote a bit more and concluded by saying, "I did not enjoy the service in the least. On the contrary, I enjoyed the service in the evening, which I attended voluntarily." Of course, when the First World War broke out, the British and Dominion forces had to expand massively, and the Army Chaplains Department was exactly the same. And it's reckoned that there were about 5,000 chaplains in British and Dominion forces. Just as an example, there's a sort of group of them. This is the Australian Imperial Force breakdown, 400 plus of them, and the ratios more or less fit with the denominations of the soldiers serving in the Australian Imperial Force. So quite a large demand on ministers. Now, in terms of the postings, where the troops are going, they were going. And of that 5,000, 179 of them died on active service. Some killed in action, some died of things like Spanish influenza. And this chap here, Noel Borden, he died of Spanish influenza. He came from Nunforth up near Middlesbrough and is educated at Charterhouse. And if you look at the bottom line of the inscription on his headstone, that might give it away, because that's the motto of the school. And he died, as you see, on the 16th of November 1918, so just after the armistice. And he had two brothers who were killed in the war, and one of them was killed just a few days before the armistice. But he's a fairly typical chaplain. In terms of the postings, on troop ships, often they were the older chaplains, hospital ships, the training camps have sprung up everywhere, and of course hospitals. The functions, I think, were pretty self-explanatory, as you'd expect, providing ministry to the troops, attending or officiating at burials. The welfare activities and entertainment and so on were particularly important because troops had to be sort of occupied in their spare time and they had to be kept away from certain attractions. There's a particular Australian general I'm interested in, and he spent quite a lot of time in Egypt, and he summed up Egypt along those lines quite nicely in a line that, to the best of my knowledge, has never been adopted by the Egyptian Tourist Board. And he said, Egypt is a land of sun, sand, sin, sorrow and syphilis. I'd also pick out censoring letters, and I know that quite a lot of chaplains found that quite a distasteful thing, prying into the private writing of ordinary soldiers. But anyway, from the troop ships and so on, they went on active service, and here's a group at Gallipoli in the Dardanelles in 1915. And then, of course, they would have gone off to other theatres of war, not necessarily in the front line. This is for Dacre. Aeroplane Dacre?
Big aeroplane.
That isn't Dacre, by the way.
In fact, Dacre suffers from vertigo.
Yeah, it's quite adventurous, isn't it? In fact, the photographer took one head-on of that aeroplane. It was used in the British Airways Pilots magazine a few years ago. Right. It was in the competition. And then, more seriously, though, they were up there with in the front line with troops, and when the wounded were collected, they were a very common sight. There's a lot of photographs around of them administering to wounded soldiers. And plenty of them, as I say, were exposed to danger. And I've got a piece here which we used on the recent Letchley Battlefield tour. It comes from this book, Some Desperate Glory, by Edwin Campion Vaughan, who was commissioned in the Royal Warwicks. And it's entirely about his experience on the Western Front in 1917. And the piece we used on the battlefield tour was purely about the 16th of August 1917. I'll do a whole talk on that there if you want. And he reports that at 2 o'clock in the morning they left their camp near Ypres in the Ypres Salient with their padre. And they went up across the battlefield. They crossed the canal running north from Ypres, where he said the air was poisoned by a terrible stench that turned me sick. In the dim light, the water appeared to be a green, dark green swamp wherein lay the corpses of men and horses. Shafts of wagons and gun wheels protruded from the putrefying mass. Then as they advanced, he said at 4:45 in the morning, he recorded that the whole earth burst into flame with one tremendous roar as hundreds of guns fired their first round of the barrage. Then they got closer and closer to the German front line. And he says he gave the signal to advance, which was answered by every man rising and stepping unhesitatingly into the barrage. And then inevitably the casualties started, and he said, I saw fellows drop lifeless while others began to stagger and limp. I was following Corporal Breeze when a shell burst at his feet. As I was blown backwards, I saw him thrown into the air to land at my feet, a crumpled heap of torn flesh. sick with horror, I scrambled over him and stumbled down into the cutting that was the steam deck. Now that's a stream, that's a prominent feature on the battlefield where we stopped a few weeks ago. You know, Private Bree, or Corporal Rees, was extremely badly wounded. Lost several sort of limbs and had other sort of classic wounds of an artillery shell. The Campion, Edward Campion Ball, went to see him, and he said his feeble hand clutched my equipment, then the light faded in his eyes. The shells continued to pour, and we gave poor Breeze a burial in the shell hole, and the Padre read a hurried prayer. So there they were, right up there with the troops in the front line. And that was recognised in a number of awards. This is one example. Reverend William Addison won the Victoria Cross, which we normally associate with service personnel, for gallantry in Mesopotamia in 1916, fighting the Ottomans. Then I mentioned burials, and that of course continued after the war, as graves, bodies were brought in and the war cemeteries were created. And then after a bit of a lull, of course the family started coming over and they were involved with the various pilgrimages and visits. And the couple on the far side there, with their son from the King's Liverpool Regiment. But during the reconstruction of Ypres, a significant town on the battlefields, they certainly considered the need for people coming to the battlefield to be able to participate in Christian worship. And that was realised in the construction of the St George's Memorial Church in Ypres, and it's still there today. A lot of the original families were gardeners who stayed on after the war to tend to the battlefields, to the war cemeteries, but more and more visitors to the battlefield, so it's performed that function since it was built in the 1920s. And the place is full of plaques relating to individuals and regiments, and most but not all well-known schools, the standards hanging up, so it still fulfills that function for visitors to the battlefield today. In terms of the well-known chaplains, I've chosen four. This fellow here, William Mackenzie, was actually born in Scotland and he emigrated to Queensland, and he became a Christian in 1887, and he served at Gallipoli and on the Western Front. He was awarded the Military Cross, you can see above his pocket. And he eventually went home in 1918. Later he served with the Salvation Army for 4 years in China, and then he commanded their southern district in Australia and then the eastern district, New South Wales and Queensland. He was awarded the OBE in 1935, and his name crops up in things like the Official History of Australia and the Great War and various other accounts. But about 30 years ago, the reason why I encountered him was because I was doing some research on this guy, who's a Queenslander but serving in a New South Wales battalion. And amongst he was killed in November 1916. Amongst his possessions, the family had got, was a letter signed by William Mackenzie on Salvation Army notepaper. And it gave the circumstances of Bill Gibney's death. And I was in Melbourne and popped into the Salvation Army HQ and said, can you tell me anything about William Mackenzie? And showed them the letter. And they said, oh yeah, no problem at all. And went into their archive, and there's a display case full of bits and pieces about his time in China and on the Western Front. And subsequently I've come across him numerous times. But a fine example of a chaplain serving in the Great War. Now the next one, I'm sure you must have heard of, really, yeah, Woodbine Willie. And his father was a vicar in Leeds. And he was a curate in Rugby, and then he was a vicar in Worcester. And he won the Military Cross in 1917 at Messines, which also we covered on the battlefield tour. And after the war, he was very active in pacifist circles, mainly in London. He did quite a lot of speaking tours around the country. In fact, it's while he was in Liverpool in 1929 that he died. And his funeral in Worcester was very well attended. And he's often quoted as one of the classic names of this aspect of the Great War. Now, I don't know whether any of you follow closely the House of Lords Hansard. If you don't, I'm disappointed. But in October they had a sort of debate, I suppose they call it, on the centenary of Passchendaele. And Woodbine Willie was actually brought up by one of the Lords, and I'm not sure which one. And he said this, He said Stark Kennedy had a very interesting way of trying to help people engage with those issues. He would go to the station and there would be 600 men in the canteen waiting to get on the train. Noble lords can imagine what they were feeling about getting on that train. He had a lovely voice and he would go to the piano, start playing and get them all singing. Now this construction of this next sentence suggests it's probably a Labour peer. It says, that is a bit like what can happen in a good church service sometimes. he said, you lift people out of themselves and create a spirit of connection and hopefulness and of being together. You create a situation of being accompanied on a pilgrimage and not being alone. Stoddart Kennedy got them singing and created a spirit that enabled the men to feel they were part of a movement that was worth being part of. So I think he hit the nail on the head there. Another one is John Ridley, who came from Darlinghurst in Sydney, and he, when the Australians responded to Britain's call for troops during the First World War, they created the Australian Imperial Force, a new army, and he joined it very quickly. And he became a Christian at the Baptist Tabernacle in Sydney in October 1915, just before he left Australia to come across to Egypt and the Western Front. And he was very badly wounded on the 19th of July 1916, and I came across him two ways. Firstly, from a Baptist minister friend of mine in New South Wales, who knew him very well. But he also contributed details of a relative of his who had been killed in this particular action that's covered in my second book on the first Australian action in France. But secondly, I came across really quite separately from the 350 letters that he wrote during the war that survive. And I used the... extract in chapter 15, which is called First View of Heaven. And he wrote as follows about his brigade moving out into no man's land. He said he was unable to explain how it happened. I must have raised my head slightly when crash bang, it's a terrible smack. It felt like receiving a terrible smack from a cricket ball, but 10 times worse. It hit me with the force, and for a moment I hardly knew how I'd been hit. Then the blood rushed out of my mouth and down my face in torrents. I was in agony, nearly choking every minute. Now the battlefield there is crisscrossed with drainage ditches, so it's very low lying. And a couple of his mates pulled him out of the ditch onto the bank, and he said he felt he was dying and wondered what my first view of heaven would be like. Then I thought of mother and all at home, and I wondered what they would say when they saw my name listed as killed in action. And later he said, the muddy ditch was tinged with scarlet around my body. But he had a number of operations, a shot through the throat, and he survived. He was commissioned later on, and he won the Military Cross in the last 100 days of the war. And as far as I'm aware, he ran the only Bible study group in the Australian Imperial Force during the First World War. And when he returned home, he ran a sort of itinerant ministry using his caravan to go around parts of Australia. And once their daughter was born, who's still alive in Sydney, he was based on a church in a couple of churches in New South Wales. In the Second World War, he served in the Royal Australian Air Force as a chaplain, and he founded some organisations, some of you may have heard of, the Campaigners for Christ, which aimed to train evangelists, and the Australian Institute for Evangelism is another one. And he died in 1976, and very well regarded in Baptist circles. But of course, what you're hoping for with these people is that they leave a lasting impression. And this chap, I'm sure some of you will have heard of, Reverend Philip Clayton, known as Tubby Clayton to one and all. And he, funnily enough, was born in Queensland and came back to this country aged 2. And is educated at Oxford, and he was a vicar in Portsea in Hampshire when the war broke out. And he and a friend of his, called the Reverend Neville Talbot, took possession of an empty house in Poperinghe, which is just a few miles west of Ypres, still within range of the German guns. And they turned it into a sort of rest centre where anybody could go in, regardless of rank, and everybody was treated as equal, and have a cup of tea and something to eat. And it's named after Neville Talbot's brother, who had been killed in Belgium earlier in the war. This is the outside, so it's called Talbot House. And inevitably, its name was shortened using the then Royal Artillery phonetic alphabet, and it was known as
Top cage.
Brilliant, well done. So that's the origin of the top cage, and that's one of the places Gary visited on the Battlefield tour. So you realise what you all missed. Of course, one of the features of all the 4 points of the compass of Top 8 is the kingdom of God, to witness humbly, to work for a better world through the example of friendship, service and fair-mindedness. And upstairs in the house is the chapel here, and there's a lot of stories of troops going up there, attending services, and a lot of baptisms before they went out back to the front line, many not to return. I think this is a really strong reminder that even during the sort of really grim periods of the war and the desperate situations that they found in, that God is present, and that Christianity remains with a lot of these people for the rest of their lives. There you go.
Thank you.
I understand, Paul, that you'll take questions from the floor.
That's easy ones, yeah.
Well, if you'll take a question from a seat rather than the floor. What did church parade consist of? I'm not quite sure what that would be.
Sometimes it was just an address, and other times it would actually be things like communion service. Yeah, and often you see, particularly for battles, very well attended communion services. And then they had the more formal, what they call the drumhead services, back sort of away from the front line. And often you get a whole division, you know, 10,000 men turning up for a church parade, and that would have really just been a sermon and a few prayers, and that's about it. Mm. Yeah. And how many of them can actually hear it, I don't know.
Paul, there were very many Indian troops on the Western Front.
Yeah.
How were they catered for?
Right. I did wonder about including other denominations, and they had their own sort of ministers. And in fact, when I was looking at the casualties, I noticed in East Africa and West Africa there were quite a lot of native chaplains as well. So yes, they were catered for. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the Chinese Labour Corps as well.
Sort of observation or a bit of knowledge that I have rather than a question, but my grandfather was a rector in Bradford at the beginning of the First World War, and I did, when I was quite young, read some of the magazines that were produced at that time, and I was horrified by the way in which he was urging all these men to join the Bradford Lads Brigade.
Oh, yeah.
You know, was that part of the Christian sort of role of clergy?
Well, they you have to think about at the time the empire was under threat from Imperial Germany, and people responded. I got a particular interest, obviously, in the Australian, don't pick that one up, but their response was staggering when war broke out, and nobody clearly knew what was to come. But key people in the community did play a very prominent role. And of course, a lot of the animosity lingered on. In Heston in Middlesex, I came across a grave once, and I remember sort of Doris Smith, who died in 1935, and her husband Albert, who was killed fighting the beastly Hun. So quite a lot of that was quite easy to whip up, I think. Clergy, they did play their part from the pulpit, encouraging people to do their bit for king and country.
So there was a lot. One of them had a Victoria Cross.
Yeah.
And there was a few MCs in that.
Yeah.
You only get them if you're actually in a battle.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a fight of some sort.
Yeah.
Presumably they were involved in fighting.
Well, they would have been up there with the troops, and they invariably it's recovering wounded or attending to wounded in very dangerous situations. Addison went out into no man's land and brought several men back under fire. So that's why he got his. But there were several other clergy who got the VC, and they had similar situations.
So there never actually four arms.
Oh, no, definitely not. No, definitely not. No. A bit like the Royal Army Medical Corps, they didn't.
No.
So, but Peter then got the VC for military, yeah.
So could you be a conscientious objector on the chapel?
I think you probably could, because lots of them served in ambulance services and in hospitals. But I imagine you probably could, Andrew, yeah. Yeah. So you weren't bearing arms.
Were they reprised upon, weren't they?
They certainly weren't popular, no. And they were, and the authorities came down on them very, very hard. Very hard.
But there was no conscription until 1960.
Yeah, that's right, January 27, 1960.
For 2 years, it wasn't an issue.
Sorry?
For 2 years, it wasn't an issue.
That's right. Yeah. But once conscription came, there were these committees where people asked to be deferred or released from military service altogether. But again, they were pretty tough. And they might give you a couple of months to sort things out, and then off you went.
Paul, my father was a chaplain in the Second World War, right. And one of his jobs, he didn't talk much about it, but I know one of his jobs was to write to the next of kin, usually the wives, of people who've been killed, giving them as much as possible the details of how they were killed.
Yeah.
And then he received letters back from them sometimes saying how much that had helped them. Mm. And we've still got the letters somewhere, I don't know where.
Really?
But in the First World War, numbers must have been so incredible that they wouldn't have been able to do that sort of thing, presumably.
Well, generally it would be the officers who would write the letters.
Yes.
For them. And some of them were very accurate, others less so. Because they tried to allay the worries that somebody had maybe spent hours dying of a wound or whatever.
Exactly.
So very, very difficult job. And some of them, frankly, come across as being a bit shallow.
Mm.
The letter that Mackenzie wrote was broadly correct. When you look at it, it's in the right area, you got the details of the action more or less right. But there's a whole range of them. Can I just tell you an anecdote about that, actually? There's an officer service called a Batman.
Mm.
And there was this officer commanding an infantry battalion who was very hard of hearing, and he went out to Doban's Land one night, and his Batman happened to be the sentry on duty. And when he came back in, the sentry challenged them, and the guy didn't hear him. So the sentry challenged him again, he still didn't hear them, so he opened fire and killed him. And so they thought, oh, this is going to be difficult writing home. So they wrote a letter saying he's killed in action. Anyway, at the end of the war, as you saw on Noel Howden's gravestone, the family could choose an inscription to go on the bottom. And this family, believing he'd been killed in action, chose one that says, "A good job done, our good and faithful servant." Where's that effect? So, you have to be very careful what you wrote. Yeah. David, David White, he's got one from an officer about his father being killed, which is reasonably accurate. I think it's quite well written as well. But you can see that it was done probably sitting in a shell hole after the battle, because part of it's crossed through, and then he just carries on writing. Probably stuck in an envelope.
Oh, just a point. I think it probably means grandfather.
Grandfather, sorry. Yeah.
Not
grandfather.
You, Fred. He didn't
know. Well, great uncle.
Paul, has anybody that you know of done any research on this question for the German forces?
Not that I know of, but I imagine some
of them. What was their chaplaincy?
I think very, very similar.
Yeah,
very similar. Yeah.
Because I heard this poem: God heard the embattled nations sing and shout. God strafe England, God save the King. God this, God that, God the other thing. Good God, said God, I've got my work cut out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So all these men were all volunteers, were they?
They were, yeah. And they did weed some out who weren't really capable of sort of serving out at the front, and they probably were the ones who went to hospitals in England and things like that. It's a very tough vocation, really. Mm. Very tough.
Yeah. Well, talking about that, obviously the chaplaincy service in the forces continues.
Mm.
We've actually had a speaker here who was a couple of years ago from the RAF chaplaincy service. He was
The wing commander, the Reverend Stephen Ware, who apart from being our warden of readers in Gloucester Diocese, before he left the Air, after he left the Air Force, in the Air Force was Chaplain General of Strike Command. He did three tours of Kosovo. And he said two things which was interesting. He said that when the sirens went off, he was out running for cover when he noticed that on top of what they used as storage, which were these things like sea crates, you know, there was a chap sat on a deck chair. And he climbed to the top of the deck. Come on, nobody moved. So he climbed up there alongside this chap when all hell broke loose across the airport. And they sat there for 20 minutes until it all stopped and died away. And so on. And the chap just said, "Thanks, Padre," and got there and went. Stephen said that 90% of his work in the theatre of war was just to be there and be that presence.
Yeah.
But the other thing he said, which was humorous but obviously true, is that when those sirens go off, there isn't an atheist in sight.
Yeah. Of course, Woodbine Willie got his name from just going around handing out cigarettes to the soldiers. Yeah.
Paul, where did most of these people come from? Were they vicars of parishes or were they chaplains in private schools?
Well, I haven't done a detailed study, but Cross often came from parishes and theological colleges and places like that. Yeah, and I'm sure they got them from anywhere they possibly could, and some came back from overseas as well.
So I just think a lot of parishes would be left empty.
Yeah.
A lot of vicars went off.
Yeah.
So how old were they generally? What was the
other? I don't know. I haven't studied in that detail. There is a friend of mine in Wantage who has done quite a lot of work on vicars of the Great War period. But Mackenzie was 48 when he went home, and I think when they started getting that sort of age, they tried to then really done their bit and send them home.
I just wondered because most of the guys they were ministering to were probably about 18, 19.
Yeah.
So, and some of these pictures, they don't look that much
older. No, because they always look older than they actually were.
Yeah.
I guess you need somebody, probably regardless of their age, who can actually communicate effectively with the troops.
I mean, they had to lift the man's spirits and take the same risk, didn't they?
Yeah.
That's what this chapter came here said. He said the only difference between him and the soldiers was he wasn't armed.
Yeah.
But he was there and he took the same risks as they did.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he
spent most of his time with the RAF regiment, of course, who were getting plastered all over the place.
Do you know what their training was like? Did they do some of the same physical training?
No, I don't think they did. No. I think probably they were sort of fit enough to go out when they went overseas, then off they went. Mm. Yeah. And a lot of them would have spent time in the front line, but otherwise they'd have been perhaps in the sort of hutted camps a little bit further back. So it's still a pretty harsh existence, but. And then obviously they've been back in the big towns like Amiens and on the coast and so on. So plenty of them saw their fair share of danger.
I'm sure some of those coming back would have had the same problems that troops coming back had, suffering from what we now call post-traumatic stress. Because I know a couple of chaplains around now who have been in those positions and have got just that.
Yeah.
And had to virtually give up being a vicar in a country parish.
Yeah.
Because it would come over them without them realising.
Yeah. I was going to include in this, and in fact I took it out last night, a short piece about, there's a book about, it's called something like Shattered Heroes or Solemn Heroes, which is their experience when they came back after the war and how they influenced the Church of England at the time. And of course a lot of them went on to higher office. When the Queen was crowned, I think there were about three members of the clergy standing around her, and all three of those had been decorated in the First World War. Yeah, but I'm sure you're right, Gordon. There were some who probably lost their faith, and some who carried on quite normally.
Yeah. Sorry, can I just stop you? Neil, could you do us a favour and put your head around the corner of the kitchen and say, for 5 minutes, and then I'll get a body ready for us? Thank you very much.
And of course, those still at home, you may get to look at, let's say, with Reverend Brownrigg. He was doing his bit in the village and keeping in touch with soldiers and their families. And of course, in the Second World War, he lost his son and HMS Hood. So it started all over again, in 1939. Mm. Yeah. But, as I say, those who are on the battlefield tour, you remember Talbot House, don't you? And it's quite, quite an impression it makes on you.
On behalf of all of us, Paul, thank you very much. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Somebody once said it makes you think, doesn't it? Yeah. There'll be a short break while the ladies are putting things out. Chris will tell me what you ordered if we can't remember.
Can,